This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Black Reckoning, Book 3 of the Books of Beginning, by John Stevens. Read for you by Jim Dale. Chapter 16. The Caryadin. Emma woke once during their journey to find that darkness had fallen and the wizard had hung a lantern from an iron spike in the front of the boat. They were still moving at the same steady pace, and, raising herself up, Emma could see other lights, presumably of other rowboats, strung across the water and fuzzy in the misty darkness. She listened for the sound of the metal ship's engine, but heard nothing. Emma felt woolly-headed and heavy-limbed, as if she was somehow still asleep or dreaming, and she lay down again and fell fast asleep. She woke once more. It must have been hours later, and saw cliffs ahead in the darkness, a shoreline, and there was a break in the cliffs, the mouth of a river, and it seemed they were heading toward it. She felt anxious and tense, and was sweating, though the night was cool.
"What is troubling you?" the wizard asked.
"Nothing."
"I don't think you're telling me the truth."
"Fine. What do you know about the book?"
"The what?"
"That's great. You're real helpful. Row the boat." In truth, she hadn't expected much, and what really did she need to know besides that they were getting closer? And they were. The tugging at her chest was stronger and more insistent with each stroke of the wizard's oars. So why did she feel so unsettled? She let her mind wander, and soon found herself thinking of something Michael had said the night before, when they'd all been gathered around the fire. He'd said it almost in passing, while talking about the Reckoning, what it did, why it was called the Reckoning. He'd said there were two meanings to the word. One was something you owed, the other meaning was judgment. Emma had no problem with the idea that the book could kill someone, in this case, the someone being the Dire Magnus. But the idea that she'd have to judge a person, and judge them for what, on the basis of what, she had no idea, made her deeply uneasy. Killing someone felt fast and full of fury. It was over in a moment. Judging someone, you had to think about stuff. There'd be things that weren't clear. She didn't want that responsibility. That kind of thing was more for Kate, or even Michael. But didn't she want to be their equal? Yeah, but not like that. There had to be some, well, easier way. And was that even really it? For as she sat there, swaying with the movement of the boat, Emma found herself remembering the dream she'd had that first night in the land of the giants. In the dream she had come upon the book, only to be set upon by thousands of shadowy figures. Then, as now, she had woken trembling and sweating. Why? What was it about the book that scared her so?
"You should try to sleep," the wizard said.
"Oh, be quiet," she muttered, then lay back down and was asleep in an instant. When she woke again, there was a hand on her shoulder. The boat wasn't moving, and it was light. The wizard was leaning over her. She pushed his hand away and sat up. The boat was moored at a wooden dock at the edge of a brown-green river. There were a few other boats tied up nearby, but they looked neglected. She could see a path going up the bank and, in the distance, sloped roofs and the grey stone walls of houses. It was very quiet, and the light was oddly muted. Emma didn't see anyone else around. The wizard climbed onto the dock, and she followed, adjusting Michael's dwarfish knife so that it was tucked snugly into her belt.
"What is this place?"
He shrugged.
"It's very curious. I'm not sure where this is, or why we're here. I only know that I am taking you where you have to go, and we are not there yet. Come, my dear."
In so many ways, how he tilted his head slightly to the side when he was thinking, how he called her "my dear," how he seemed to feel no need to explain anything, and just assumed she would follow along, which, of course, she did, He was Dr. Pym, and yet, without his memories, he wasn't. It confused her and made her uncertain about how to approach him. Emma let herself feel the pull of the book. He had indeed brought her closer. Then she coughed and realized that her eyes and throat were burning, and that what she'd taken for cloud cover was actually a low, thick ceiling of smoke. "What's burning?" The wizard said he didn't know. He began walking up the pier.
"Where are you going?" Emma asked.
"You must be hungry. We will get you something to eat. Then I will take you the rest of the way. That is my charge."
Somewhat grudgingly, Emma followed him down the dock and into the village. It looked like she was stuck with him for a while, and though she never would have admitted it, part of her was glad.
"Where is everybody?" Emma said. "What happened to this place?"
They were walking through the center of what could have been a charming village. There were stone houses. People had kept gardens. Trees lined the streets. But the houses were empty, the gardens brown, the trees leafless or burned and broken at the trunk. And there were small fires burning seemingly everywhere. It was like the aftermath of some war or devastation.
"I do not know," the wizard said. "Something terrible."
"Yeah,"
Emma said.
"Duh."
She said nothing more, but she felt an uneasiness, a sense of following a path that had been laid out for her long before, of walking into a trap. They came to a square lined with dark-windowed shops.
"Come on,"
she said, taking command, and led him to a small grocery. A bell tinkled as she stepped through the door, and Emma waited, but no one emerged from the back. There were loaves of bread, stale. She tried to break one on the counter and failed. Several kinds of nuts, some sawdust-tasting chocolate, fruit, apples and what looked like plums, all wrinkled and sour. And though none of it was that fresh or good, it helped quell the gnawing in her stomach.
"I don't get it," she said through a mouthful of mealy apple. "There are apples and bread and nuts. How can they grow all this stuff here? Do they have farms?"
"And what did you imagine the world of the dead would be?" the wizard asked. "A featureless desert where spirits float about, moaning for all eternity? This world is as solid and complete as the one above. There is water here. You have seen it. The air nourishes you with each breath. The land is fertile. If you can live here, then why not a tree, or—"
He looked away sharply.
"We should go, now."
He was already heading to the door. Emma followed, shoving more apples in her pockets. A few minutes later, they were outside the village, striding down a dirt road. The wizard took her arm.
"We must leave the road. Which way do we go?"
She realized he was asking her. She allowed herself to grow quiet, to feel the pull of the book, then pointed off through the burned-out forest that stood close by. Soon they were out of sight of the road, and soon after that they heard voices and the stamp of feet. They froze, listening, until the sounds had faded away.
"They're looking for me, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"It's the Dire Magnus."
"I do not know who that is, but there is a great evil in this place."
"Yeah,"
Emma said, fear giving an angry edge to her voice.
"It's the world of the dead. Course it's evil. Look around."
The wizard shook his head.
"The world of the dead is not evil. Indeed, it could be a paradise. Imagine that village we pass through, full of noise and people. Imagine this forest, green."
"You gotta be kidding."
"You do not believe me, but the fact remains that those who hunt you brought their evil with them. This world itself is blameless. It exists only as the place where the dead wait."
"What are you talking about?"
"Wait for what?" "To be reborn."
He spoke in the same automatic way he had in the shop, like someone who'd been taught a thing by rote.
The universe has been created and destroyed over and over. It's happened before and will happen again. The spirits of the dead bide here until the time of rebirth. It could be 1,000 years or a day. To the dead, it is all the same. They exist in an eternal present.
Emma thought she understood what the wizard was saying, that the dead just hung around here till the universe started over. But she couldn't get past the idea that when you died, you forgot everything you had built up in your life, including the people you were closest to. No wonder all those people walking on the road had looked like zombies. Everything that had mattered to them had been stripped away.
But why do they have to forget who they were? It's not fair.
The wizard shrugged again.
That's death, child.
With her eyes watering from the smoke, Emma gazed out at the burned and blackened forest. The wizard could say what he wanted about its being a paradise. As far as she was concerned, this place was hell.
Let's just find the book so I can get out of here.
The farther they walked, the more difficult it became to breathe. When they reached a stream, the wizard wet a cloth, which Emma tied around her mouth and nose. The smoke grew so thick that she even let Dr. Pym take her hand so she could walk with her eyes shut, relying on him to warn her of roots and rocks. Finally, she felt him stop.
Open your eyes.
They had come out of the woods, and Emma looked, half knowing what she would see.
I've been here before.
The wizard actually seemed surprised.
How is that possible? The Diamagnus pulled my spirit out of my body and sent it to look for the book. I saw things, this place, the fires, and I saw this.
They were standing before a nearly vertical rock wall that rose thousands of feet into the air. A winding, twisting staircase was carved into the rock. High up, Emma could see dark clusters that she took to be birds.
He sent my spirit into the world of the dead. I guess I should have known. I never really thought about it. I didn't want to.
Just then, there was an explosion above, accompanied by a furious collective cawing, and a black cloud swirled down toward them. Emma's instinct was to duck, but Dr. Pym gripped her arm, silently commanding her to be still, and the swarm of birds swept over her head once, twice, and then flew back up the cliff. All except one. Emma saw that the bird, her mind supplied the word raven, had landed at the bottom stair. And then it was not a raven at all. The creature now before them had the body of a human, with a human's legs and arms, but a raven's head, with a great, shiny black beak. It was wearing a dark cloak with a hood. It was the same one she had seen in her vision.
A Caryadin, the wizard said, a guardian of this world. It will guide you the rest of the way.
What?
You're leaving me with that? My charge is ended. I can go no farther, and it will not harm you.
Emma looked at the bird creature, then up at the cliff. She could feel the book close by. The old wizard knelt, placing a hand on her arm.
I do not remember you, or your brother and sister, or any of my life before this. But if I injured or betrayed you while I was alive, I can only ask for your forgiveness.
Emma stared at him. She didn't want to forgive him. She was still hurt and angry, but she found herself, against her will, thinking of all the things he had done for them, all the times he had been kind or patient or understanding, moments that had felt real. Not planned or manipulative.
Maybe you thought you were doing the right thing, or you had some idea how to save us, I don't know, but you weren't always terrible. Thank you.
And before she could stop him, the wizard hugged her, and before she could stop herself, she hugged him back.
Goodbye, he said,
then stood and turned away into the trees. Wiping the tears from her eyes, Emma looked at the bird creature, and though its beak did not open, she heard the words in her head.
"Come, Emma Wibberley."
It began walking up the stairs, and Emma had no choice but to follow. The creature's cloak was ragged at the bottom, almost like the feathers of a very old bird, and its bare feet were blackened and calloused. They climbed, winding back and forth over the face of the cliff, and the steps were so steep that sometimes Emma had to go on all fours, and as they climbed, the other ravens flew about, as if daring her to step out into the air. Finally, she stopped.
"I have to rest."
She sat on one of the steps and looked down, trying to see if she could spot Dr. Pym. But either she was too high, or the smoke was too thick, or the birds circling through the air blocked her view. Then she looked farther out. Perhaps a mile or so distant, past a steep, rocky ridge, rose a column of black smoke, thicker and wider than any other, and she felt a tension and nervousness in her breast. What was happening there? Unconsciously, she inched forward, as if to gain a better view. Her foot slipped, and she felt a tumbling drop in her stomach. She was sliding, falling. Then a hand grabbed her shoulder, roughly pulling her back. She was shaken, trembling. She looked at the creature on the step above her.
Thank you.
Again she heard its voice in her head.
Come.
They kept climbing, up into the thickest part of the smoke. Emma's vision was blurry with tears, and she was coughing and hacking almost constantly when they finally stopped on a small ledge. Before them was a cave tunneling back into the rock wall. Emma stared into the darkness. The pull of the book was like a second heart straining against her chest. The creature began to turn away.
Wait!
Its black eyes stared at her, inhuman and unreadable.
It was you, wasn't it, or someone like you, that the Countess gave the book to? Michael said she gave it to a spirit or something. It was you.
The Caryadin said nothing.
And you sent Dr. Pym to get me, didn't you? You made him bring me here. He said you're a guardian of this world. You think me taking the book away will help fix things?
Emma didn't know how she knew all this, but it felt suddenly so clear. She could feel the intelligence thrumming within her, stirred by her proximity to the book. Then she heard the voice in her head,
"Goodbye, Emma Wibberley."
And she gasped as the creature launched itself out into the air and, while still keeping the shape of a man, giant black wings opened from its back, and the Caryadin soared down and out of sight.
"If he could do that," Emma muttered, "why didn't he just fly me up here?"
Then she turned and walked, alone, into the cave. The air in the cave was cleaner, more breathable, and Emma's eyes stopped watering and she coughed less. She had switched on Michael's flashlight, and she felt a kind of giddiness and was soon hurrying forward, almost recklessly, as the tunnel curved deeper into the rock. And then, abruptly, she was at the end, and there, resting on a ledge carved into the back wall of the tunnel, was the book. For a moment, Emma stood there, her chest heaving, as if unable to believe what she was seeing. She had actually done it. She had come into the world of the dead all alone. She didn't count Dr. Pym. She hadn't asked him to come, and really, a monkey could have rowed the boat, and she had done it. She felt a deep stirring of pride that she, the youngest, the one who everyone thought was only good for punching and kicking people, that she had done something no one else could have. And here was the hard proof that would put her on the same standing as her brother and sister in one leap. All she had to do was reach out and pick it up. But still, she hesitated. For being the Book of Death, Emma thought the reckoning could have been a little more impressive. Granted, its corners were rimmed with dark metal, but the book was both smaller and slimmer than either the Atlas or the Chronicle. It almost looked like a diary. Had it really sat here for 2,000 years? Had it been waiting for her all this time? Yes, Emma thought, without knowing how she knew it had been.
So, pick it up, then,
she whispered, and her voice echoed back, urging her on. Her hand trembled as it came into the beam of light, and she lifted the book off the rock shelf. It felt no different from any other book, the metal corners cold and slightly sharp at the tips, and she ran her fingers over the pebbled black leather of the cover. Her heart was beating fast. She set Michael's flashlight on the ledge so its light shone out into the cave, and, taking a deep breath, she opened the book. It was blank, but she had expected that. The Atlas and the Chronicle had also been blank. Despite the coolness of the cave air, Emma could feel herself beginning to sweat. She knew she didn't have to go any farther. She had the book now. She could just take it and find her way back home. She'd already accomplished what she'd come here to do. She laid her hand, palm down, on the open page. It felt like the top of her head was ripped open. She cried out and staggered backward, the book tumbling to the ground. She stood there, gasping, trying to process what had just happened. The book had fallen closed upon the floor. For a long time, she didn't move. She must have done something wrong, or triggered some kind of alarm or trap set to scare people off. She just had to try again. She thought she could hear something in the cave, whispers circling about, growing closer. She ignored them. Emma reached toward the book, her hand trembling badly, and placed her palm on the page. It was the same as before, but worse, because she kept her hand pressed down. A million voices, shouting, crying, desperate to be heard, clamored inside her head. She could feel her own self being trampled on and torn apart. She fell backward again, her head ringing, her heart shuddering in her chest. Whose voices were they? What did they want? What were they doing in the book? A memory came to her of her dream that first night in the land of the giants. In the dream, shadowy figures had crowded around her, pleading, shouting. She took a deep breath and tried to pull herself together. She just had to get help. She would take the book back to the world of the living and get someone to show her how to shut off the voices so she could use the book to kill the Dire Magnus. Then she looked up and froze. Words were appearing on the open page. Release them. Emma raced down the rocky stairs, 2 steps at a time, hardly seeing where she was going. She held the book clutched to her chest. She had to find Dr. Pym, or that bird creature. They would know where to find the portal to the world of the living. Then she was at the bottom of the cliff.
Dr. Pym! Dr. Pym!
No answer. Her throat burned horribly. She shut her eyes. She could still hear the voices, whispering, nipping at the edges of her mind.
Hello?
A man with a hairy gut sticking out of his black leather tunic stepped from the trees.
Who are you, then?
Emma turned to run and collided with another man who shoved her to the ground, took the dwarfish knife from her belt, and quickly and expertly tied a cord around her wrists. She struggled, but he knelt on her, patient, as if he had done this many times before. Then the first one returned with a line of men and women, their wrists bound like Emma's, and the tall man pulled her to her feet and tied her to the others.
"What's this?"
said the fat man, picking up the black book from where Emma had dropped it.
"Little bit of light reading? Mine now."
He shoved the book into the top of his pants.
"Don't," Emma said. "That's my..."
The other man struck her hard across the mouth.
"Shut it."
Then to his companion,
"We're late. Come on."
And Emma, tasting blood, was pulled away. Chapter 17. the thing on the beach. Cake woke, rubbed her eyes, and looked about, trying to remember where she was. She was in a narrow canvas tent. Sunlight streamed through a gap in the front flap. She had slept in her clothes, not even bothering to remove her boots, and she could feel how her body was covered with a grimy film of sweat. Michael lay with his back to her on a cot a few feet away. From outside she could hear voices, footsteps, hammering, the clinking and scraping of metal, and she could smell breakfast, eggs and bacon and coffee, and what she would have sworn were pancakes. And suddenly her stomach felt like a great hollow pit inside her. She couldn't go back to sleep. And by then, too, she had remembered the night before, the meeting with King Robbie, and what he had told them about Emma and the portal. "Hello!" There was a voice outside the tent. It belonged to a dwarf. "Yes?"
"Ah, you're awake. The king would like you both to come to a council, quick as you can. And I brought you something to nibble on. Nothing fancy, just a dozen or so scrambled eggs, poached eggs, fried eggs, 4 or 5 rashers of bacon, pancakes, toast, marmalade, currant scones, blueberry scones, this little frittata I whipped up."
After Kate had woken Michael, told him about the council, and the two of them had crammed in as much food as they could, as quickly as they could, they followed their escort, an old dwarf with a wispy grey beard and very large floppy ears, across the camp to King Robbie's tent. In the daylight, Kate perceived that the island was in the shape of a large, stretched-out horseshoe, the whole thing set on an incline. Downhill lay the various tents and encampments, and Kate could see hundreds, perhaps thousands, of men and dwarves moving about, making their breakfasts, checking their weapons, while beyond them lay the beach and blue water of the marina, where she and Michael had arrived the night before, and where the small fleet still sat at anchor. Looking directly ahead, past the green tent of the Dwarf King, was what looked like a field of enormous wildflowers. In fact, they were brightly coloured tents and pavilions, blues and greens and pinks and yellows, and, moving among them, Kate could see hundreds of elves. Some of them must have been playing music, and the tunes seemed to Kate to somehow be a part of the morning sunlight, to echo the distant sound of sea, the movement of the breeze, and it calmed her. She could see a few elves polishing swords and making arrows, but most of them were simply combing their hair, or, it appeared, giving advice to others about combing their hair, demonstrating technique, and so on.
"They're keeping away from each other," Michael said.
"What?"
"The three camps, the dwarves, humans, elves. None of them are having anything to do with each other."
He was right. Each of the camps had clearly marked its own territory, and none of them, humans, dwarves, or elves, were to be seen among the others. This did not, Kate thought, bode well. Kate then briefly turned her gaze uphill toward the camp of the refugees. These were the families who had lived on Loris. She could see them, husbands and wives, old people, children. "The Dire Magnus is hunting us," she thought. "We're responsible for what happens to them." As they approached the entrance to Robbie McClower's tent, Kate and her brother could hear raised voices, all talking, or rather shouting, at once.
"Our goose is cooked. We might as well admit it."
"Perhaps if we hadn't given up, Loris. We had no choice. You knew that. An assault on the Dire Magnus now would be suicide."
"If suicide, if he gets his hands on the reckoning.
Perhaps if a few of those elves at home doing their nails were to come help us." "They won't follow a dwarf. I've said that. Perhaps if you cleaned your ears or any part of your body."
The old dwarf pulled back the flap and said quietly,
"Good luck."
And Kate and Michael walked inside.
"Oh, yes. Well, it's good to see you too, lass."
Harold patted Kate on the back as she continued to hug him tightly. Harold was alive. That had been the first and best surprise to greet the children when they entered the tent, and Kate had raced over to throw her arms around him. In truth, her joy at finding the red-bearded dwarf alive surprised even her, as she didn't really know him all that well. But when it felt like they were losing people left and right, having Harold come back against impossible odds meant there was hope for all of them, hope for Emma. The dwarf's face was still streaked with smoke and blood and dirt, and his right hand was wrapped in a clean bandage, but he was here. He was alive. "When did you get back?" Kate asked, finally letting him go.
"Just before dawn," he coughed.
"Captain Anson went back and rescued him," King Robbie said. "Found him swimming along a mile or so from Loris, for which we are indebted to our allies."
And he nodded at the elf king, who waved his hand breezily.
"That's the size of it," Harold said, "though I could have swum here if I'd had to."
"Really?" the elf king said. 30 miles of open ocean?"
"You've never seen me swim," the dwarf all but roared. "I'm a veritable guppy."
"Well," Kate said, "thank you again. You saved our lives."
"Nothing to it, lass."
And the dwarf's weathered face softened to something like an actual smile. Kate and Michael were given chairs on the right side of King Robbie, and in many ways the council was a reprise of the one they'd attended in the Rose Citadel a few days before. Around the table were Magda von Klappen, the stern Austrian witch, Master Chu, the plump Chinese wizard, Hugo Algernon, Captain Stefano, the bold commander of the Guard of Loris, the silver-haired Lady Gwendolyn, King Bernard, Wilhelmina's father, and Harold and King Robbie. The differences were that this time there was no Dr. Pym. Several of the council members displayed wounds. Captain Stefano had a bandage around his head and one arm in a sling. And from the glares being passed around, any pretense of civility was gone. Kate suspected it was all Robbie McClower could do to keep them from attacking each other. When the children were seated, the Dwarf King addressed himself to Kate and Michael.
"So then, I've told the council what happened to you all, where your sister has gone to get the reckoning, and where she might appear. We've been discussing what we can do about it."
"Find a well-stocked bar and wait for the roof to cave in," grumbled Hugo Algernon.
"Dr. Algernon," the Dwarf King warned, "I told you, none of that."
"Before we go further, I have some distressing news," King Bernard said. "I've spoken with our colony back in Antarctica, and they inform me that the gateway to the world of the dead has inexplicably closed itself off."
Kate said nothing, but she could feel panic beginning to stir inside her.
"Right," King Robbie said grimly. "Then that leaves the portal on the Hebrides."
"I'm afraid," Magda von Klappen said, "that I just received word that that portal has sealed itself off as well."
There was a long, heavy moment of silence. Kate reached out and took Michael's hand, even as he was reaching for hers.
"I see," the Dwarf King said. "And any idea why?"
"The books," Hugo Algernon growled.
"You need another answer? And what's it matter? It is what it is. There's only one portal left, and we all knew it would come to that, didn't we?"
"But could that one," Kate's voice trembled, "closed too?"
"Doubtful," said Master Chu in his calm murmur. "It is the oldest of the gateways, and the strongest. It forms part of the axis between our world and the world of the dead. Were it to close, then the entire universe would most likely come to an end."
"Well," King Robbie said, after no one else had spoken, "I suppose that's reassuring."
But in fact Kate was reassured, and she felt Michael squeeze her hand.
"I'll ask a stupid question," Harold said.
"By all means," King Bernard said magnanimously. "That is your right as a dwarf."
Kate saw Harold, his face flaming as red as his beard, whirl toward the Elf King, but Robbie MacLauer put a hand on his arm.
Go on, Harold.
It's just that, say this child comes through the portal with the reckoning, why don't she just kill the Dire Magnus right then and there? End this whole thing. Ain't that what this is all about? Getting this fancy book so we can kill him?
I think that's an excellent question, Kate said, and she looked hard at the Elf King, but only for a moment, for the Elf King looked at her with eyes of such unparalleled blue and with such sweetness of expression that she found herself having the odd thought, I bet he's a wonderful dancer. And the Elf King even gave a tiny nod as if to say, I am. I'm a wonderful dancer.
Unfortunately, it is not so simple,
Magda von Klappen's stern, clipped voice spoke from across the table.
The fact is, these books are fantastically complex magical instruments. They require time and skill to master. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was some time before either of you could fully use your books, was it not?
Yes, Michael said. That's true. And Kate found herself nodding as well.
So the wee lass might come through with the book, having passed through who knows what horrors in the world of the dead.
The Dwarf King paused and looked apologetically at Kate and Michael, though probably nothing too bad.
Oh, it will be horrible,
Magda von Klappen said.
Count on that.
But, as I was saying, she won't even be able to use its power to kill the fiend. She'll need help from you lot.
Robbie MacLauer nodded at the wizarding contingent.
Exactly so,
Magda von Klappen said.
Ha! Barked Hugo Algernon.
You've something you want to say, Doctor?
The Dwarf King asked wearily.
Yes, I have something to say. First off, Magda von Klappen here wears old lady underwear. I know because I saw her washing it this morning.
This is ridiculous. I thought she was washing a bed sheet or maybe a tablecloth, but they were her knickers, all right. Second, even if the girl could use the reckoning, haven't any of you realized that she probably won't get the chance?
This silenced everyone, even Magda von Klappen, and Hugo Algernon glared around triumphantly.
Yes,
Michael said quietly. The entire council turned to look at him, even Kate, who wondered what Michael knew that he hadn't shared.
What do you mean, lad? The Dwarf King asked. What's he getting at?
Well, Michael said, adjusting his glasses, you have to question the coincidence of the Dire Magnus attacking Loris and taking control of the portal right before Emma is going to come through it with the reckoning.
You mean, Robbie MacLauer said, he knows she's in the world of the dead?
Possibly. If so, he'll be waiting for her. So, even if she could use the book, like Dr. Algernon says, he wouldn't give her the chance. He'll have some trap set up.
But how would he know? King Bernard said. You think he has spies here?
Maybe, Michael said, though there is one other explanation. Hugo Algernon was nodding.
At least two people at this table aren't total morons. Bright lad. Like his dad, in that. Of course, I taught his dad, so I get most of the credit.
What do you mean? Kate asked. What other explanation?
Michael looked at her. That the Dire Magnus planned it all. Our escaping from his fortress, discovering the Countess's remains, bringing her back to life, finding out where the reckoning is hidden. Think about it. If he knew where the book was, then he would have also known that only the Keeper of the Reckoning could pass into the world of the dead, so he would have made us think we were doing everything ourselves, and all the while he knew Emma would be bringing the book right to him.
But how?
Kate said, her throat so thick she could scarcely speak.
How could he have done that?
Michael shook his head.
I haven't figured that out. He would have had to have been pushing us along, somehow.
Michael was still staring at her, and for an instant Kate thought, he knows. He knows Rafe has been appearing to me. But even if Michael did suspect, what did it matter? He was wrong about at least one thing. It had been Rafe, and not the Dire Magnus, appearing to her. And yet, a voice inside her asked, could she say that for certain? When it came down to it, what did she have that she could point to besides her own belief that it had been Rafe, and not their enemy who'd come to see her on Loris, and then again in the Land of the Giants? And did she truly believe it, or, as she'd wondered before, did she just want to believe it? Wasn't the very fact that she had avoided saying anything to her brother and sister proof that she had her doubts? She felt her heart beginning to race, and gripped the arms of her chair to steady herself. For if it had been the Dire Magnus manipulating her all this time, that meant she had done the one thing she'd never thought possible. She had chosen someone else over Michael and Emma, and in the process, she had doomed them all. She could see Michael looking at her, trying to read in her face what was happening, and when Lady Gwendolyn, the silver-haired elf, began speaking, it was with immense relief that Kate turned from him and looked across the table.
"If we may speak of practical matters,"
Lady Gwendolyn said,
"we cannot open a portal into the garden of the Citadel. We all know there are wards to prevent such a thing. But what of the Atlas? Its power could override any such defense. It could take a band in to rescue the girl and bring her back here, where we could instruct her in using the book."
"Maybe it's just something's happening with the Atlas." Kate had had to swallow before she'd been able to speak, and her voice was far from steady. She hoped the others, mostly Michael, would hear it as nervousness about using the Atlas.
"I can't control it the way I used to. Leaving the Dire Magnus's fortress, I tried to take us to Loris, and we ended up in the Giant's Land. Then, last night..."
And she thought again of the pain she'd felt when she'd used the magic.
"I mean, I'll do whatever you think best. I just don't know if we should count on it."
"I'm guessing you've felt the same thing, haven't you, boy?"
Hugo Algernon was almost glaring at Michael from beneath his bushy eyebrows.
"When you used the Chronicle?"
Michael nodded.
"Yes, I felt it."
"Well, that's that,"
the man grunted and crossed his arms, as if he'd definitively proven some point that only he understood.
"So,"
Robbie McClower said, in the tone of someone trying to keep things on track,
"what we've got is that the Dire Magnus might or might not have planned this whole thing. I vote for he has, though I've no idea how he managed it. Might or might not be waiting for the lass. Again, I go with he is. And we've no way of simply magicking ourselves into the garden, fine. But still, we have to get in there and get the girl and the book before he does, or our collective goose is bloody well cooked. Is that about the size of it?"
"There is also the very tricky issue of timing,"
King Bernard said. The elf had, Kate reflected, the longest eyelashes she'd ever seen.
"When will the girl come through? Tonight? Tomorrow? She could be appearing right this very moment, while we sit here, bathed in dwarfish body odour."
"He know!"
Harold started to rise, but King Robbie's hand on his shoulder forced him back down.
"And before anyone raises the prospect of a small band sneaking into the garden to rescue the girl, consider they would have to remain there, undiscovered, until such time as the girl appeared. A proposition, I think, with little hope of success, The fact is, the only sure way for us to protect the child and keep the enemy from gaining control of the Reckoning is to retake Loris and the Rose Citadel and hold it ourselves till she comes through. But seeing as we just abandoned Loris... Unnecessarily,
muttered Captain Stefano, the first words he'd yet spoken.
And our forces are weaker now than they were then. That would seem an impossibility. What are we therefore to do?
I told you, Hugo Algernon said, make our way to a well-stocked bar. I know a couple, if anyone's interested.
Everything King Bernard says is correct, Robbie McClower said, anger burning in his eyes, except in regard to retaking Loris. It ain't impossible. All's we need is a bigger bloody army, and we've got one, just waiting to be snatched up.
He jabbed a stubby finger at the Elf King. How many Elf clans are there spread around the world? Dozens! How many of those elves, not counting the ones you brought yourself, have shown up to help us? Zero. He whirled on Captain Stefano. And you, Captain, despite all your grumbling about abandoning Loris, you've yet to call in the oaths from the other humans in the magical world. As I recall, each one of them is sworn to protect the island and the citadel. But we've not seen hide nor hair of any of them, so don't tell me it's impossible, because it's not.
The other elf clans will not come to fight under a dwarf,
King Bernard said crossly.
Even though I've told them that for a dwarf you are almost completely unobjectionable and rather clean. And I have tried contacting the other fiefs,
Captain Stefano said.
No one will be the first to move. They say they pledged their oath to the city of Loris, not to a dwarf king.
So I'll step aside,
King Robbie cried, slapping the table. You can be the bloody general, or you. I don't care. Harold shook his head.
Your Majesty, you know well that the dwarf battalions who've answered your call wouldn't follow an elf.
And I,
Captain Stefano said wearily, raising his wounded arm,
am in no state for the job.
Michael pushed his chair back and stood. The action was abrupt enough that it silenced the table.
What is it, lad? King Robbie said. You have something to say?
What? Oh, no. Just... His face was red, but Kate saw that it was not anger. He was blushing. The princess is here. Kate and the rest of the table shifted about and looked toward the entrance of the tent. Wilhelmina stood there, wearing a dress the color of the desert sky. Her hair shone as brightly as if she'd been dipped in the sun. Perhaps having been embarrassed by Michael, Robbie McClower, Harold, Master Chu, and even Hugo Algernon all stood.
"Welcome, Princess," King Robbie said. "There's a chair next to your father."
"She can sit here,"
Michael said, indicating a chair beside him. "I mean, if she wants to."
"Thank you,"
Wilhelmina said. The dwarves and the two wizards remained standing while Wilhelmina floated around the table to the chair Michael was holding. Then, after pushing it in and asking if she wanted anything to drink, she didn't, Michael glanced around, saw everyone staring at him, and turned even redder. It was as if he'd forgotten they all were there. But then Kate saw a change come over her brother. It was as if he had said to himself, "Well, so what?" And he stood up, a little straighter, and when he spoke, his voice was clear and strong.
"There's something I'd like to say. While you sit here arguing, my sister has gone into the world of the dead, alone. Something no one else has ever done. She's risking her life to save all of us, not just me and my sister, but all of us, and she's 12 years old. So, no disrespect, but you need to grow up."
He sat down, and as Kate and the others watched, the elf princess, smiling with pride, took his hand, and Michael, though he blushed even redder, did not pull it away. The first person to speak was King Robbie.
"Hold now, hold now!" A smile was creeping at the corners of his mouth. "I believe I'm getting an idea."
But they were not to hear what it was, for right then Captain Anton rushed in to say the island was under attack.
"Where?" King Robbie roared.
They were in the sunlight outside the tent. There were screams, people running around, pandemonium. King Robbie was holding an axe, as was Harold, and Kate saw that King Bernard and Lady Gwendolyn both had their gleaming swords out and by their sides.
"On the northern shore, it looks to be a single raiding vessel, perhaps a scout. They came up over the cliffs."
"The northern shore? Bloody princess! I left my bracelet in my tent."
And then Wilhelmina was gone, a flash of gold streaking away. King Robbie looked at Kate and Michael.
"You two stay back."
Then he roared for the others to follow, turned, and began running up the island's hill. Kate threw one glance at Michael, and they both took off after King Robbie, Captain Anton, and the others. As the island sloped gently uphill, it meant that Kate and Michael had a clear view of what was happening. They could see, perhaps half a mile away, the dark shapes pouring over the edge of the cliff and toward the families and children from Loris. But Kate and Michael had run only a short way when both were roughly grabbed by the backs of their collars.
"Right, hold it. You heard the king."
It was Hugo Algernon.
"What are you doing?" Kate demanded. "We can help."
"You can help more by not being dead. Oh, hello."
Throngs of people were pouring toward them, running away from the attackers, while from behind rushed a wave of their own soldiers.
"We're gonna get sandwiched," Hugo Algernon said, and he lifted them in his arms and turned sharply to the left.
After a minute of huffing and rough shaking, he'd reached the edge of the island and set them down atop a small cliff.
"There," he said, "safe enough."
"But how did they find us?"
Michael said. "I thought this island was invisible."
"The Dire Magnus has dozens of ships out looking for us. Get close enough, it's not hard to see the enchantment. Now, you two, be good kiddies and wait here, and maybe I'll buy you an ice cream later. Stay here, I mean that."
Then he turned and ran toward the battle that was now going on at the upper end of the island. The air was thick with cries of fear, the clanging and crashing of metal, and the shrieks of Moram Khadi.
"This isn't right," Michael said. "We should be allowed to help, and—"
He was cut off by a scream, a child's scream, and both he and Kate turned. 30 yards below them was a rocky beach. A pair of children, a boy and a girl, perhaps 7 and 8 years old, stood on the beach as a creature, an imp, Kate saw, climbed out of the water toward them, a black mace in one hand.
"Kate!"
The imp grabbed the boy, lifting him up in the air. There was no one else around, no one to help. As the creature lifted the mace, Kate seized Michael's hand, reached inside herself for the magic, and stopped time.
"Kate!"
Michael's voice was strangely flat and toneless, and yet it was the only sound in the world. Kate tried to speak, but she felt a great crushing pressure on her chest.
"You stopped time, didn't you? You... are you all right?" "We have to get down there. I can't hold it long."
There was a narrow path winding down the cliff, and Michael took the lead. Kate followed, every muscle in her body shaking with effort. She felt that every second she kept time suspended, she was doing terrible damage to the world and to herself. When they reached the beach, Michael ran forward and yanked the boy from the imp's grasp. He bent to pick up the girl as well, but he couldn't carry both.
"Kate, we have to... what are you doing?"
Kate had rushed past Michael and stopped a foot from the imp. She was too weak to carry the girl, and if she restarted time, the imp would catch them. She pulled a short, ugly sword from the creature's scabbard. She heard Michael say her name again. Bracing the sword with both hands, her vision seemed to be clouding over, she held the blade, trembling, tip out toward the imp.
"You have to run!" she shouted. "I'll hold it here as long as I can. Get help!" "Kate, no!"
She let time restart. And she had just said, "Don't move," when the imp rushed forward, impaling itself on its own sword and knocking Kate to the ground. The last thing she remembered was the back of her head hitting a rock. Chapter 18 The Lost Tribe. The boy who'd given them a ride from the village stopped his truck and told them he could go no farther. "Okay," Claire said, speaking as the boy had in Arabic. "We'll get out." And she called out the window to Gabriel and her husband, who had ridden in the truck's bed. "This is as far as he'll go." It had been a 4-hour trip, and the truck, a rusted-out, loosely bolted scavenged job of 3 or 4 different trucks, had seemed at the point of rattling apart with every bump and pothole. Indeed, Gabriel was surprised they'd made it this far. Now, lifting his pack and sword, he climbed out, the whole truck tilting sharply as he swung himself over the side. The children's father climbed out next. Like Gabriel, he was covered in red-brown dust, and he unwrapped the scarf from his head, took a sip of water from his canteen, swirled it around in his mouth, and spat to clear the grit. He gave his wife and Gabriel a smile. "So, that was awful." The boy had maneuvered the truck around and was already headed back the way they had come. Alone, the group turned and looked about. Gabriel had been to many places in the world, but never anywhere quite like this. Narrow, stony mountains lurched upward all around them, tilting this way and that at odd, almost impossible angles. Richard had explained that thousands of years before, the land here had been lush, and rivers had carved strange formations in the rock. But now there was no water, and the landscape was all burnt, red and brown. Even the sky, thick with dust, was lit red by the setting sun, as if the air itself was on fire. The sound of the truck had already faded, and the silence was complete. The rutted path they had been following snaked upward over the rocks.
"He said there's nothing up here,"